Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Business Report, our weekly podcast on the global defense and aerospace business, sponsored by Bell Helicopter, a Textron company. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Tensions with North Korea continue to soar in the wake of President Trump's first UN General Assembly address, setting off a tit-for-tat set of exchanges that included a rare personal message from Kim Jong-un. Trump called Kim a suicidal little rocket man who would be totally destroyed, while Kim called Trump a dotard, and North Korea's foreign minister told the world body that Trump's insults make a North Korean attack on the United States all the more inevitable. Meanwhile, Republicans have mounted their latest drive to repeal the Affordable Care Act and floated a $1.5 trillion tax cut plan, are grappling with hurricane-related recovery costs as Puerto Rico has been flattened and many parts of it remain without power, as Senate negotiators deliberate the outlook for defense spending. Last week, the Senate passed its version of the National Defense Authorization Act that would increase the Pentagon's base budget to $640 billion, but kept spending caps at $550 billion. Here to talk about the week are Gordon Adams, Professor Emeritus of American University and a Stimson Center Distinguished Fellow, Nora Bensahel of American University's School of International Service, and Byron Callen of the independent equity research firm Capital Alpha Partners. Guys, welcome back.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Gordon, let me start with you, and let's talk a little bit about the budget, but I would like all of you to sort of weigh in on this. Enormous number of pressures now. You have the Affordable Care Act, the repeal, the Graham Cassidy measure. That over the weekend was updated in order to put sweeteners to make sure that your senator, Susan Collins, comes aboard as the Lisa Murkowski of Alaska to members who have expressed reservations. You've got $1.5 trillion tax cut plan, which is a key part of both the GOP, but also President Trump's agenda. And you've got, you know, storm-related recovery. Talk to us a little bit about how all of this is going to come together in budget deliberations this fall.
Well, you kind of have a perfect storm to kick the most significant parts of the budget process down the road to December. You know, they're going to have to vote the storm relief, you know, will have a significant impact on projected deficits for this, the next fiscal years. But I'm not sure that anybody cares too much about that when there's a storm and a disaster. People generally want to appropriate the money. The healthcare debate has sent everybody sideways in terms of dealing with these bigger issues of budgets and budget resolutions and tax reform. And I have to say that the sense that I have is that Susan Collins's concerns about the Graham Cassidy Act are not of a nature that are going to be bought off by an additional infusion of dollars. They really are about process and long-term organization of the structure and pre-existing conditions. And she's laid out a pretty complete list over the last 48 hours of the things that concern her in the bill, which an infusion of cash is probably not going to buy her off. So I think Graham Cassidy goes down. She would be the third clear no vote. But that's going to leave them with, you know, the problem that they always had, which was how do you fix the Affordable Care Act and what bipartisan process can be instituted to done it, something that was cut off at the beginning of the month by Graham Cassidy. The real question is, are they going to be able to write a budget resolution that ties the Congress into a tax reform process? That's going to be the big discussion. Republicans are circulating a draft outline that would reduce both the individual and corporate income tax rates. It's really not reform. It's really just a cut. But if they're going to be consistent with a budget resolution, they're going to have to pay for it somehow, right? And the pay-fors are going to hit various exemptions and deductions that both business and individuals in the middle class have taken advantage of. So it's not clear how easy that process is going to be. But once they pass that budget resolution, and once we pass September 30th, if they pass it, the options for doing health care reform at 50 votes simply disappear from the table, and we're kind of back to zero on that process.
And just a quick point, it's unlikely to buy off John McCain either, who's talked about getting back to regular order, and that any health measure we do will be better if we bring Democrats into the picture. Byron and Nora?
Yeah, I'd just add that the bigger budget picture, everything Gordon said is right about the upcoming debates, but as we look towards December, when they're going to have some bigger choices to make about the future of tax reform and how all of this spending comes together, the biggest question is how strong are the fiscal hawks going to be in that debate? Right? The budget caps put in place by the 2011 Budget Control Act still remain in place. There has been votes to increase the defense budget, in particular the base budget, to $640 billion. But as you noted in the intro, that is well above the budget cap. So if the fiscal hawks choose to put up a fight, then we're in for a lengthy fight come fall. But if they don't, if they decide that the combination of storm relief and tax relief and all sorts of other things is more important, then we're going to see deficits just mushroom, and the constraints that have been in place from the Budget Control Act will no longer enforce that kind of discipline.
Byron?
Well, I just add, I think, both to Gordon's and Nora's points, I think the storm issue is really an interesting wild card, because some of the initial estimates after Harvey were about $150 billion for Harvey-related federal aid. I haven't seen anything coming out of Maria yet, but, you know, the situation in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands is pretty dire right now, and it may be easy to forget that there are about 3.5 million people who live there. And, you know, to see Puerto Rico fall back into what would essentially be a 19th century economy with their electrical grid effectively destroyed, it's probably going to be a fairly massive aid effort. And, you know, where I think we can focus on FY18, but I also think this is going to matter a lot for 19 and 20, because these deficit projections, CBO had been looking for we would be back at a $1 trillion kind of deficit in FY22. I've got to believe we're going to hit that number a lot sooner, given, you know, the prospects for tax reform, the federal aid that's going to be needed for these storms, and then whatever deal, if a deal can be done on the FY18 budget, which will be above the caps.
Let me make two predictions in light of this discussion. Prediction number one, I'm going to go way out on a limb here and suggest that the outcome in December is an omnibus appropriations bill with more money for defense than is in the caps, and because it's going to rely on Democratic Party support to pass, more money in it as well for domestic spending, and the only difference from prior years will be that defense will probably go up more than domestic, which breaks the sort of one-for-one rule that the Democrats have previously applied to their support for an omnibus appropriations bill. I see no appetite in the Republican Party right now for a frontal assault on deficit reduction. I think Byron's probably right. Projectively, out there in the future, when the numbers get truly humongous, maybe Pete Peterson or his son will kick back in and there'll be more effort on deficit reduction, but I simply don't see it now.
Yeah, and I would say there's probably got to be a market reaction to this at some point. I mean, that's kind of the interesting factor, is you can afford these debt levels or deficit levels with low interest rates, but if interest rates start to rise and the interest payment burden starts to rise, that's, I think, when people are going to start paying more attention. But for now, I agree with Gordon. I think this year, you know, the word austerity has kind of been expunged from the discussion that's taking place about the budget.
Gordon, let me ask you, I mean, you were paying attention when Graham Rudman was crafted. What triggered Graham Rudman in 1985-86?
First off, there was $300 billion deficits, not trillion-dollar deficits, but relative to the, you know, changes in pricing since then, probably close. So it was very large. But secondly, you really did have a very strong wing in the Republican Party that wanted to get the deficit under control. A balanced budget amendment was right in front and center in the party ideology. You had the David Stockmans of the world doing rhetoric through the Congress at this point in time. You had Ronald Reagan routinely campaigning on the rosy scenario numbers that would get the American deficit to zero, you know, and you had the kind of thing that Byron's talking about, market pressure, interest rates saying, let's get this thing under control, let's get it down. I think the whole ideological and political context is now completely different, and you don't have the kinds of champions that you had in Graham, Phil Graham and Warren Rudman and Fritz Hollings carrying this thing through. When Hollings joined that on a bipartisan basis, it really pushed it through the Congress.
Let's go to the threat picture, and Nora, I want to get your take on this. The president's advisors advise them not to belittle the North Korean leader. North Korean leadership has always responded relatively negatively to being mocked, belittled, and the president has been doing that fairly incessantly. You know, the president's message to the UN was fairly consistent. He also challenged the nuclear deal. The Iranians have since conducted a missile test to underscore their disconnection, that whatever we do on missile tests is not connected with the nuclear deal. Talk to us about the whole picture here and where we're going, and whether or not language could matter in a potential conflict, because the North Koreans are now talking about the possibility of, you know, making an atmospheric hydrogen bomb test.
Language definitely matters, and what we've seen over the past week, this escalation of words and insults between the leaders, is incredibly destabilizing and dangerous. In some ways, the speech that Trump gave at the UN with his incredibly provocative statements about, you know, if provoked, we will destroy North Korea, has in some sense given Kim what I think he wants most, which is a level of direct engagement with the United States. He's always wanted to be able to deal with the United States to try to come to some resolution on this rather than going through the intermediaries of China and others. numbers. But just that kind of rhetoric increases the room for some sort of miscalculation or mistake. And neither of these two men, you know, tends to check their egos at the door and back down when confronted. So the potential for escalation here is great, both in words and in deeds, as you mentioned. Yet the North Koreans have threatened to conduct a nuclear test over the seas of the Pacific that would involve a launch path that would go over Japan, most likely. And the potential for something to go wrong with that at every stage, from the launch to the flight to the eventual detonation over the Pacific, would be incredibly high, as well as environmentally dangerous and potentially putting many, many lives at risk, again, in the case of an accident. So you've seen this rhetorical rise, you've seen the potential for miscalculation, for accidents. It's just a very, very dangerous and destabilizing set of developments that was really self-inflicted by these two leaders.
Byron, Gordon, how do you guys see this?
I read it very much the way Nora read it, and it's this kind of escalated rhetoric that pushes us even further, with people like Duncan Hunter arguing for a preemptive attack. And I don't know any potentially comparable situation, except maybe Nixon trying to communicate the message that he was unpredictable, where we're worried in this case not just about the unpredictability of the adversary's leader, but about the unpredictability of our own leader, that makes this so strange, even scary. You know, where the strong hand of restraint and diplomacy enters in here is unclear to me. It's not clear to me what Kelly could do here. It's not clear to me what Mattis is doing aside from phone calls at night reassuring people that the president doesn't mean what he says or isn't going to do what it sounds like he's going to do. You know, this is a strange and unpredictable kind of shaky universe that we're in here, and where the restraint comes from, I don't know. And it's not clear that Tillerson and the State Department are providing that kind of diplomatic steady hand as we go through this crisis. It makes it additionally worrisome.
No, they're not. And the American public doesn't support this either. There was a new poll that came out over the weekend that said that 2/3 of the American people oppose a preemptive attack. The number of people who said that they trust Trump a great deal or a good amount to handle North Korea was only 37%, with the number saying that they trust him not at all to deal with North Korea is 42%. So he's not being restrained by his advisors. We're not being restrained by diplomacy, and he's not being restrained by the American people. That's a very dangerous situation indeed.
It reminds me of the Lyndon Johnson quote, though, that, you know, our adversaries have caught us bluffing. What is the danger of that? Because there are a lot of, the New York Times had a great story quoting Emmanuel Macron, sort of doubting, you know, that Trump has a tendency of painting himself into a corner without giving himself a way out. How badly does that, I mean, you know, the Republican Party was good at pointing this out about Obama all the time, the red line comment and the like. What are the strategic repercussions of, you know, I'm not, just to make clear, making the argument that we should go to war in order the president doesn't back down or something. But what are the repercussions of sort of such harsh, strong rhetoric, given that you want to be relatively consistent in your messaging worldwide?
And well, Vago, we're in a kind of situation. I mean, it's interesting. This is the week that the Ken Burns Vietnam documentary is running.
That's where I heard the Johnson quote, actually. So right. Extraordinary piece of work.
Absolutely. And if you look at, particularly in there, the excerpts that he did from the transcripts of phone conversations that the president was having, two things struck one. Thing one is the level of analytical depth was surprisingly superficial for conversations between the president and the Secretary of Defense, for example. And the other was that the things that really concerned Johnson as president were his reputation, the reputation and credibility of the United States, not so much the outcome of the war itself, which he clearly sensed we didn't have the capacity to win, but the internal political calculus of his ego, his reputation, his concern, the country's credibility, a whole bunch of things that got in the way of sound judgment on what was coming out of the war effort itself. I'm afraid we appear to be dealing here with a president who doesn't even have that level of self-consciousness, that it is really all about ego, and that's extraordinarily dangerous.
Byron, you're a historian in your own right. How do you see this?
Well, I think you're right. You know, you're seeing it. You know, the other event that happened last week was Iran tested a long-range missile. You know, U.S. policy has not deterred North Korea from doing what it's been doing. And I find that fascinating in its own right. And if you're not deterring North Korea, you're not going to be deterring other countries as well. So this is probably going to get a lot worse. And I agree. I don't know, you know, I wouldn't advocate for a preemptive strike on North Korea, far from it. But I think, you know, what does it mean? What does it imply? I think you're going to see more countries kind of step up, either out of their own fear that they're going to be subjected to the same sort of focus and rhetoric, but without the attending action that would really take them down.
I see that slightly differently. I think the Iranian test has more to do with our threats to end the nuclear deal and, you know, playing to domestic audiences there. I think it's pretty clear around the world, if not within the president's mind, that deterrence with North Korea has failed. We are no longer in a world of prevention. We are in a world of deterrence. But that trying to deter the North Korean leader is not the same as trying to deter some other world leaders. I do think what other countries and potential adversaries will take away from this is that the way to challenge the United States is to go ahead and do your own thing, is to stand up for what you believe you need to do for your own security and see where that takes you. Because the president, if he paints himself, continues painting himself into corners like this, and because of the nature of his personality and his reactions, I think it's very clear that he is going to respond to being challenged in any way through similar kinds of statements and rhetoric, that we're going to see a lot more challenges coming our way as a result, not because deterrence doesn't necessarily work with other countries, but because they perceive a president who is relatively weak and may not be able to follow through on all of the threats that he makes, even if he does on some.
I think that may be part of it, and what we're seeing here, Vago, I think is at a more fundamental level, the kinds of rebalancing or redistribution of global power and global impact that's been going on probably for 10 or 15 or 20 years now. The combination of bluster and weakness that Trump has put out, it seems to me, are accelerating that process rather than slowing it down.
Are there any budgetary implications to all of this? Or is it, you know, any different than we've said, greater investment in missile defenses and the like?
Well, I think all of that's going to follow. And if military action of any kind follows with North Korea or later on with Iran, you're obviously going to see the defense budget already through the roof entering the stratosphere. You know, inevitably, when people get nervous and worried and scared, they want to pour more money into the defense budget. So all the vectors for the defense budget are up. It's really a question of how much.
We last week had an interview. It was great fun interviewing both Ron Fogelman, former Air Force Chief of Staff, and Tony McPeak, former Air Force Chief of Staff, who were award recipients, and we partnered with the Air Force Association on that. And you know, it was interesting that Tony McPeak's take on it was that he doesn't trust deterrent theory with the North Koreans. And so basically he was like, look, you've either got to, you know, get him to give him up, or you've got to take those weapons away from him so he doesn't threaten people, even if it means going into a conflict, because the conflict will only be worse a few years down the road when they have a greater nuclear capability. And that the attack may be necessary on North Korea, especially if it's to defend the United States and U.S. territory, that he said, you know, the single most important obligation is the defense of the United States and its citizens. It was a very sobering conversation with him.
I'd be curious if he felt the same way. You know, you had the same debate kind of play out with China. I think there should be a look at history in some of these instances, because I'm sure we had those arguments, different administrations, different military leadership. But we did go through the same thing with China when they were acquiring their own nuclear force.
Yeah, Byron's absolutely right about that. I'm sure, having not heard anything more than your version, I don't agree with Tony McPeak on this subject at all, that we haven't, you know, begun to test real deterrence with the North Koreans. And in an odd kind of way, the stability with which the North Koreans have developed their nuclear capacity without using it has been quite extraordinary. And it clearly fits, to my mind, into a deterrence kind of scenario. He wants to keep the United States from overthrowing his regime. And that, you know, since the United States has routinely talked about regime change and routinely looked forward to the day when the Kim regime disappears in North Korea, there's more than a small margin of reason for him to be worried about it. So I'm not sure that I agree with what you've described as Tony McPeak's argument here, you know, and I would have expected him to be a little bit more careful. His contribution to the Burns documentary was quite extraordinary for its wisdom and insight and honesty.
Yeah, and I'd be a lot more convinced by that argument if we knew where the weapons were, right? We haven't talked at all about what an actual conflict would look like, right? We're talking about the possibility of it breaking out. We don't know where all the weapons are. Any preemptive attack would almost be certain certain to fail to destroy all of their weapons, which leaves the possibility of a retaliatory response. We're talking about death and destruction on the Korean Peninsula because it wouldn't remain limited to a strike. We're talking about a possible attack on Seoul and beyond. We're talking about a devastating military conflict that could erupt even by attempting a preemptive strike. And all of that has to be figured in as well. I was, you know, sort of wondering when you were talking about what the implications of this on the budget, what it looks like if we actually were to engage in that kind of conflict and the expenses that we'd be talking about in both money and lives, to be clear, not just American, but Korean in particular, that we'd be dragging out for a very long time.
And just to make clear, General McPeak made it very clear that diplomacy has to be the first way because of the potential implications of it. But, you know, his take was that at some point it may come to that and we have to be ready to do it, in part because it will be worse later than now, especially as a threat to the United States. Look, I'm somebody who has subscribed to the deterrent theory that, you know, it's much better rather than talking around the edges and making believe the country is not a nuclear power when it empirically is, accept them into the nuclear club, treat them by the rules of the nuclear club, which everybody is governed by. And ultimately, that then becomes your deterrent equation. And then you can open up a conversation or a dialogue or a hotline or whatever, you know, in order to try to de-escalate tensions. We're getting very short on time. Byron, I want to get your take. You were at the AFA annual Air, Space, and Cyber event, you know, the marking of the start of, you know, the school year and fall in Washington. Tell us what some of your key takeaways were from AFA this year.
Well, I mainly focused on some of the programs. Vago, I really didn't spend a lot of time listening to leadership, which I missed, unfortunately. But look, it's pretty clear, you know, TX is going to be a hard-fought campaign. Boeing had, you know, a full-scale mock-up of their airplane, which is pretty impressive. But I kind of came away from the show with the sense this is going to be a much tougher competition, that it's not a layup for any of the three primary teams competing. And then on the OAX, it's pretty clear the Air Force still needs to figure out what they want out of that particular product. You know, they were asking.
And that's the competition for new light counterinsurgency aircraft for the Air Force, given that we're going to be engaged in counterinsurgencies for a long time. Let's try to, you know, free up some fast-moving jets for other missions around the world as opposed to that relatively low threat environment mission.
Absolutely. And, you know, they're being used successfully in Afghanistan, the A-29. The Beechcraft model is being used in Iraq. So, but I still think, you know, there are comments, the Air Force is, you know, asking how do we conduct air-to-air refueling with these airplanes. So I think the Air Force has a way to go and really kind of understand how to use these airplanes. There will be a demonstration this spring and they'll move it along, but you know, I came away, that program's got a ways to go.
And any wrap-up thoughts, whether the SASC hearing on the Dunford renomination or anything else?
That's going to be easy. That's going to be an easy reconfirmation for him.
Walk in the park.
I absolutely agree. There's a HASC hearing on Army Tactical Network Modernization. It's going to be pretty interesting because of problems on the WIN-T program. And, you know, the whole jitters acquisition strategy, someone should write a book on that and, you know, how Harris came in with their Falcon radios. But that's, you know, kind of more of an inside baseball thing. But I think that hearing is going to be interesting just as kind of shining a light on a problematic area of Army acquisition.
It is incumbent on me at this point to say that because we mentioned some of these, especially the TX, that Leonardo DRS, which is bidding the T-100, is one of our sponsors, as is Boeing, who's bidding its airplane with Saab. Guys, thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate it and look forward to having you back on next week. On global markets, it was an equally action-packed week. Boeing hosted an investor event in Charleston, South Carolina. Speed News held a conference in Toulouse, and the U.S. government is expected to back tariffs that Boeing wants imposed on Canada's Bombardier, setting up a high-stakes showdown with two of America's closest allies, Canada and the United Kingdom. Defense and mid-cap stocks were at an all-time high as the Federal Reserve starts reducing its balance sheet next month. And lost in all of this is Qatar's order of 24 Typhoon fighters from the Eurofighter Consortium. Here to talk about the week on world markets are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America and Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners. Guys, welcome back.
Thanks, Vago. Good evening.
Yeah, thanks, Vago. Great to be here.
Well, it certainly is a very action-packed week. Ron, I want to start with you because you were in sunny Charleston, South Carolina for the Boeing Investor Conference. Talk to us a little bit about what the mood and the message there was from the Chicago-based giant.
Yeah, great question, Vago. So they held a conference down there, and it was both, you know, discussion with management and tours of the facility. And, you know, walking away from, you know, the facility, it was beautiful. You know, they're turning out 5 787s a month. And what you notice when you first walk through the facility, there's not a lot of inventory laying around. There's not a lot of people. people. There's a lot of airplanes moving through the facility. There's a lot of automation. I think one of the reasons they wanted to bring us all down there was to show us how well they're doing on the industrialization front on 787 as they're contemplating a potential launch of this new middle of the market airplane, what we call the 7M7. Part of the 7M7 business case will be, you know, we can bring this thing to market at a very affordable cost. And I think part of this trip was to demonstrate to the market community that, you know what, we really do have our hands around the manufacturing side of this. And, you know, it really was a pretty spectacular tour, and they seem to be doing a great job down there. And then one piece I might add, they did mention how, you know, they've really been welcomed with open arms by the community down in Charleston, and they compare and contrast that a little bit with what was, you know, their situation with the IAM out in Seattle. But they did say
interesting. Because the unionization effort failed there, so Boeing took it that as a big victory.
Yeah, and just little things like when the hurricane came through, they had to move all the tools that was outside back into the factory, and when they had to move it back out, they asked for some volunteers. They had low expectations, but a lot of people showed up and moved everything back out. It just seems to be just a different mental model about how they think about the company being there. They did say this, though, which I thought was very interesting. By having one line out in Everett and one line down in Charleston, you know, with both lines running with kind of two separate crews, but the same process, you have different folks looking at the process, you know, from different vantage points, and then they take the learning from one line, apply it to the other, and vice versa. And it seems to really be working for them. So, you know, I walked away from that. I'm impressed. And I think most people were too.
And what was the upshot of the Speed News conference?
A lot of talk about Collins and UTX and vertical integration and supply chain and kind of what this all means and, you know, kind of where we go to from here. And one of the big takeaways was, if you really do look at all the different systems that, you know, Collins UTX supplies on an airplane, it's one of those things where you just got to give them a wing and a tube and they can stuff it.
This really does come back to the issue that Boeing had with GE bidding for Honeywell back at the start of the last decade, where, you know, by one deal, the value add and the, you know, effective control of the integration and the systems of the aircraft moves from the prime contractor to, you know, this upstart new super subcontractor. So
yeah, it's kind of like a tier 0.5. Yeah. They're sort of the first tier 0.5.
Yeah, 0.5 or even a little bit less, isn't it? And you remember the headline, I think it was in the New York Times, did GE just buy Boeing and Boeing didn't notice it? And here we've now got, has UTX just effectively bought Boeing and has Boeing not noticed it? Except, of course, they've probably done the same thing to Airbus as well. I think the response of the two OEMs, and they'll do it through the antitrust process, would be my take on it, will be absolutely fascinating to watch.
Ron, also, I thought that was very funny how you simplified, it's just a tube with wings and you just stuff it, because I think there are a little bit more challenges associated with that. But let's get to, and Sash, I want to get your take on this, because last week, Ron took a little bit of a break because of DSCI, and we wanted to get your thoughts on that. But talk to us a little bit about how all of this is going to play with the Commerce Department seemingly ready to back the Boeing tariffs against Bombardier, and what's that likely mean between the United States, Canada, and especially the United States and the UK, where the Prime Minister depends on members from Northern Ireland as their coalition, and Bombardier has a major factory in Belfast.
I think Boeing has underestimated the degree to which, when you take a company like Bombardier on, you are taking a national champion on. And national champions, you know, they're defined by the broad political backing for them. You know, yes, they want to sort of kill the C-Series and kill it fast, because that was the mistake they made not doing that with Airbus 35, 40 years ago. But the degree to which the Canadian government has just immediately said, well, if that's the case, you can kiss goodbye to an F-18 deal. I'd be fascinated as to whether the two sides of Boeing talked about this and whether they actually just thought that was a price worth paying. If so, whoa, that's a big ticket. From the UK's point of view, you know, Shorts, which is the Bombardier subsidiary that does a lot of the aerostructures for the C-Series in particular, is an absolutely totemic business in Northern Ireland. And what's interesting about Shorts is not just totemic within Northern Ireland, but it's actually totemic within the unionist community in Northern Ireland, which has, you know, some slightly uncomfortable political undertones about it anyway. But it's in the heart of the unionist community, which is effectively the Protestant pro-UK part of Northern Ireland. It's in the heart of that community in Belfast. I think the UK government, as you say, supported by unionists in Parliament, just felt they could not let this one slip, and they got put under a lot of pressure by the unionists. Now, I think the UK government is very uncomfortable about this whole process because, as you know, we've talked about before, the UK government doesn't do a defence industrial policy. We don't really do defence policy, and if we do, it's that the services just buy what the hell they like. But the UK is very overextended in terms of how much we are buying from the US. And that splits basically F-35 from Lockheed Martin and Chinook, P-8 Apache from Boeing. And it suddenly gets very politically uncomfortable for the UK to be reminded that the UK government, the MOD, is just writing these checks to Boeing, and then Boeing is coming and causing immense economic damage to Northern Ireland and hence immense damage to the UK political scene. And, you know, this is the sort of really completely out of left field thing that could have a significant impact on the stability of the government.
The one thing I wanted to say, though, is when you talk to Boeing executives, they make a point that say, look, you know, our global commercial single aisle airplane business or a handful of jets that are going to Canada, it's not even a contest run.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's broad implications, okay? So when you look at this, you know, Bombardier raises a good point that in this campaign with Delta, Boeing didn't even have a horse in the race, right? So that's one thing. Two, this isn't wood. It's not metal. It's not that kind of thing. So, you know, how do you measure the values? How do you measure, you know, the damages, that kind of thing? You're very early on a learning curve too. How do you take that into account over the life? I mean, there's a lot of big questions about this, right? So, you know, clearly this will get contested for sure. Yeah, I think it can even be pushed to the WTO. So this could go on for a very, very long time. I think what you do have to think about is, you know, what's this all mean to China?
Absolutely.
Right? I mean,
yes.
Right? I mean, there's big, you know, overtones here about what this means for the C919 program and so on and so forth. And I don't know, I'm no expert on China, but I think it's an easy call to make that the Chinese government isn't going to want to be pushed around. And China accounts for what, something, you know, between the announced orders and unannounced orders, maybe something like 15 to 20% of Boeing's backlog, right? So there's some unintended or ripple effects on this that are pretty broad. And in my sense on this, this just might be a first salvo in trying to figure out how to protect, you know, the market that they and Airbus have been in for a very long time now, really alone, that they won't be forever, right? And you know, what can they do and how far they can take it?
Well, Embraer has been moving steadily up that food chain as well. So if you look forward in another 5 to 10 years, you're going to have a much stronger Embraer that's going to be in a market, much stronger Bombardier that's going to be in the market, much stronger Comac that's going to be fighting for that market.
Yeah, for sure. And what's fascinating about Embraer, as you all know, the KC-390, I think, was sort of a, you know, kind of a little silent hero at the air show this last summer. That thing's got the cross-section of a 767, right? So, you know, when you look at a company like Embraer, it's not that they could do a 737 A320 class airplane next week if they wanted to. They could probably do a wide body because they have that skill set now, right? So, you know, there's this oncoming tide, and I don't know, I don't think you can stop it. So if you can't stop it, how do you work with it? And this seems like some sort of salvo to try to prevent it, but ultimately I don't think you can.
I mean, just to go back to China for a second, we did stats on China for Airbus specifically, and you know, at its peak, and deliveries to China from Airbus go up and down a fair amount, but it's averaging in the mid 20%. And in a particularly strong year for deliveries to China, China is taking well over 30% of all deliveries. So, and you know, there is this problem that in terms of looking at the stats, and Ron highlighted it, that in terms of backlog, China never looks as important as it ends up being the day that those aircraft leave the tarmac of Seattle or of Toulouse. On that day, the Chinese are incredibly important. So they are, let's say, a third of Airbus's deliveries. I suspect they're not far off that for Boeing. I think we're going to see the Chinese substitute those imports initially for 737s and A320s within a decade. And then, you know, next stop, it's the wide body with Russia. And the wide body with Russia, there's got to be the risk that that's really quite a good aircraft. It will do the job. And if that's the case, that then substitutes for 787s, A330s, 777s. And suddenly Boeing and Airbus discover that the world has just got a whole lot smaller, because the biggest market in the world, China, and it is the biggest market at the moment, it's bigger than either the US or Europe or the Middle East, any one of those three, has just, you know, got itself an alternative supplier. I bet Boeing doesn't have the guts to take them to the WTO. And if they do, I bet it doesn't work.
And I think one more thing I think you have to think about, you know, Bombardier has worked with the Chinese in a series of JVs over the years, particularly in their transportation business. You know, the outcome of this may be you'll see a closer relationship between Bombardier Aerospace and Comac or whoever in China. And this could open up the Chinese market even more so in an unintended way for Bombardier, right? So yeah, I think you have to be really careful about the ripple effects of this one.
Yeah. If I were Bombardier, I would be going to the Chinese now and offering to give them free access to the whole of the transaction, the process with commerce and with Boeing, so that when the US tries it on China, the Chinese have got the playbook.
Ooh. Okay, so let me just ask quickly, because we've got to move on, but I want to get your quick take. Is Bombardier, from your guys' standpoint, as guy, each of you has been looking at this space for more than 20 years, is Bombardier doing anything that is any different from what anybody else is doing, whether that's Airbus or Boeing?
Don't be silly. Of course it's not. this is how civil aerospace works. It's a political, it's an economic industry. Get over it.
Yeah, I mean, I wish you had a camera. I'm just smiling at what Sash said. I mean, it's 100%. It's in line with kind of everybody does. I mean, there's different flavors and different names, you know, and shades of gray. But yeah, it's the same thing. And if you're giving, you know, more aggressive pricing to an early customer to get some momentum behind your program, that's common. I mean, that's common across the industry. You know, pick one airplane where that hasn't happened.
Let's quickly take a look at Northrop's acquisition of Orbital and how that's playing on the market, Ron. And I also want to get a quick update to see whether there's anything new with the United Technologies acquisition of Collins.
Yeah, so that one's really kind of fascinating, right? So when that news broke, it was after market close, and I think there was, you know, some worry that, oh my goodness, you know Northrop stock's going to be down, because it was a change in what they've been doing for a while. And that day, if I remember right, the stock was up about 3.5%. So the market cheered it. And as you know, I mean, they paid a premium, but they didn't pay a, you know, egregious premium. And I think the view is that Northrop has been good stewards of capital for a long time, and if they're doing this deal, there's a very good reason for it. You know, could be, you know, ground-based strategic defense, could be other things going on in space. That's what my sense is. It's a couple different deals going on, but I would say in the investor community looked at this as a very tactical transaction, and they rewarded them for it, which could beget more M&A in the space, because I think one of the fears is among, you know, defense prime, you know, C-suites, is you'll do a deal, the stock will go down. And in this case, didn't happen. I mean, that day, you know, investors said, hey, yeah, you know, good for you. I mean, that seems to make sense.
Sash, any European take on that? And any update on UTX Collins?
Look, Northrop ATK, I think the problem from the European standpoint there is that the US companies are not just a tactical bound ahead of the Europeans. They're about three tactical bounds ahead of the Europeans. You know, the big European merger in the space strategic arena has been the creation of Airbus Safran Launchers, which is the Ariane launcher business. Very civil focused, although there is a sideline in the French strategic deterrent. But, you know, Europe still got a bunch of satellite businesses. The, you know, strategic deterrents, ground-based submarine launch or anything, those are very, very vestigial, essentially, in France. And, you know, Europe is just left, I think, looking at that and just blinking and trying to work out how to respond. There's going to be a very interesting theme in Europe, but probably 5 years out, as to how Europe gets some form of strategic deterrence, particularly if the US reduces the commitment to Europe, even slightly. And, you know, this is the sort of the Trump response, but also then how Europe gets a strategic defensive capability, ATBM capability. And, you know, that might ultimately play into MBDA, but at the moment, I think European execs are just watching Orbital ATK and just thinking, you know, this is just so far ahead of our game plan at the moment. As far as UTX Collins is concerned, I mean, very briefly, you know, I don't think UTX Collins has really even started in terms of Europe. Airbus is clearly not even running the numbers. They're just I think they're starting to run the sort of the antitrust scenarios and just trying to work out how to play this. I think their strongest case is going to be with the EU, but I think they will play it any which way they can.
At the Boeing investor meeting this past week, they were very clear that they don't like the deal, that they don't see it as good for them. That's understandable. So I think, you know, whatever works are in the work on the Boeing side. What's interesting to note, however, if you look at, you know, just a couple different things, I think this past week, and maybe this was understood more broadly, but I figured out this past week that, you know, Airbus is going to start doing nacelles for the GTF, you know, vertically. You know, Boeing's going to do that for the 737 MAX. Boeing's talking about doing avionics. Boeing's talking about doing actuators. Boeing's talking about doing, you know, complex composite construction. So if you check off that box, that's a lot of different suppliers that kind of get thrown in there. So it's easy to see how they would start to want to take this more, you know, defensive stance. I would say from an investor perspective, UTX stock sold off pretty meaningfully when the deal got announced, but has recovered some, right? So I think the market's digesting it and starting to see it. And I think what makes everybody happy is, you know, global air traffic's been, you know, this year to date, grown 7.5%. So, and that's sort of like the Midas touch on all things aerospace, is global air traffic is, you know, 200 to 300 basis points above trend, and has been above trend probably for the last 7.5, 8 years. That kind of makes everybody, you know, kind of sort of feel warm and fuzzy about, you know, aerospace things. So,
Sash, let me ask you. And by the way, though, it does show the kind of political horsepower that Boeing has with this administration. That is very interesting. The company worked very early, very quickly, get alongside the president-elect, turn positive, possible negatives like the Air Force One, and turn them into positive, so much so, in fact, that on the birthday of the United States Air Force, Trump tweeted out a picture of an F-18 that had everybody at the Air Force Association show scratching their head. But I want to go to you because time is very short. Sash, give us your take. That Qatar Eurofighter deal came out of literally nowhere. Folks were looking at Qatar as, you know, a happy Rafale customer, looking at whether or not they were going to be buying American jets as well. And then the Eurofighter shows up with a sale of 24. What does that mean mean for the program? What does that mean more broadly? What's next?
You're absolutely right. This was an enormous surprise. At DSEI, the entire BA Systems sales team was there even on the Thursday, and this deal was announced effectively on Sunday. So when you have the chief BA salesman thinking that DSEI is more important than Qatar, whoa, where did that one come from? What we're seeing here, let's be clear, this is the Qataris doing what they do best, which is throwing money at a political problem. Their political problem is they're isolated by their Gulf neighbours for almost internal Gulf political reasons. That's still a pretty unpleasant row, and therefore the Qataris are going out and buying friends and influence by placing orders. And what they realised was that, yeah, they've got a Rafale order underway, they're taking deliveries pretty much at the moment, and really builds up next year and the year after, 24 of those. They've been talking about buying F-15s as well. They've never had the UK on board. The UK almost gave up in Qatar. But you know, the Qataris need another seat on the Security Council that will vote with them. They need people who can actually talk to the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and the Omanis. And if that's the UK, then hey, you know, a contract for 24 Typhoons, really cheap way of doing it. The Qataris have got a hell of a lot more money than almost anything else in that country. And that's what we're seeing here. But this is good for Typhoon. This fills a production gap at the end of this decade. It means that a Saudi follow-on, which we've been expecting, 3640 aircraft, that happens, possibly even an Omani follow-on, another dozen aircraft or so. So all of a sudden what you've got is stable production, where the market is starting to forecast in a fall in production. You've got an aircraft that's going to be in production at a very high technological level. E-scan radar for all these aircraft. So it's going to be in production well into the 2020s. And that means that the fight between Typhoon and Rafale is going to be brutal for about the next 5 to 8 years. F-18 is going to be under a lot of pressure, because otherwise that's going to be the first to fall. And it means that you've still got these two European aircraft, not only keeping the F-35 and a tiny bit honest, but it keeps the production and the design teams going for an Anglo-French, German, Italian, Spanish, add your European countries as necessary program towards the end of the 2020s. It's astonishing what 24 aircraft can do.
And you get 10 to 15 seconds to tell us what Angela Merkel is going to mean for defense markets, elected for a fourth term, even though the German right appears to have gained some traction.
I think this is good news for defense. She was already, I mean, to be totally brutal, starting the process of German defense rearmament. It's not necessarily something she likes, but she recognizes it's important, provided she has a coalition that is broadly the same shape as the last one. And we probably won't know that for a couple of weeks yet, but you know, Germany's been in coalition for a long time, so that's not a bad thing. But provided the coalition is broadly similar, they're going to keep on rearming. The thing to watch, actually, the really interesting contract in the next 6-8 months is there are a pair of communications and IT contracts. They've got dreadful German acronyms, MOTACO and MOTIV. One of them is a comms program, the other is an IT program. These are billions of euros, and they'll completely regenerate the Bundeswehr and indeed the entire German armed forces comms systems. And we saw last week Rheinmetall teaming with Rodenschwarz. So what you've got is one of the leading German land systems companies with a big systems integration capability and the leading independent radio company teaming up. You know, it's, I hesitate to say it's theirs to lose, but they really become the front runner in this one.
Let ye who is free of acronyms sin cast the first stone, Sash, is what I would say. Guys, thanks very much. Any other last words before we go?
Yeah, just keep an eye out this week. Spirit AeroSystems will be hosting an investor event in New York. And then next week following that, BWX Technologies will be hosting an event in New York as well.
Ron, thanks very much. Sash, thanks very much. We'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks for joining us this week. Please follow our daily video interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report at www.defaeroreport.com and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Watch our comprehensive coverage of the Air Force Association's annual Air, Space, and Cyber Conference and Trade Show, sponsored by L3 Technologies and Leonardo DRS, including our interviews with Air Combat Command Chief General Mike Mobile Holmes, U.S. Air Forces in Europe Commander General Todd Walters, Air Force Materiel Command Chief General Ellen Polakowski, U.S. Air Force's Central Command Commander Lieutenant General Cobra Harigian, Air Force Air National Guard Director Lieutenant General Scott Catfish Rice, and many more, as well as in-depth conversations with two legendary U.S. Air Force Chiefs of Staff, Generals Tony McPeak and Ron Fogelman, who were both honored last week by AFA for lifetime achievement. Follow us on Twitter at Def Aero Report, that's at DefAero Report, and on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report. You can follow me on Twitter at Vago Maradian. Thanks again to Bell Helicopter, a Textron company, for their generous sponsorship, and until we're together again, have a great week.